Welcome to this edition of the Reaction Podcast. I'm Ian Martin, editor of Reaction. I'm joined by Alistair Benn, deputy editor of Reaction, and Maggie Pagano, executive editor. We'll begin firstly with an apology for not having podcasted in a while. There's been a lot happening with Reaction. We've launched Engelsberg Ideas in partnership with a rather brilliant Swedish foundation. And there's been so much happening, but we are all here and up for talking now. Firstly, Alistair, about where we are in terms of the crisis, lockdown, all of that. How does the news look to you?
Well, we are at a sort of more mature stage of the pandemic, in that you're seeing further, outbreaks or peaks happen, in parts of the world that at the beginning of the epidemic we thought had kind of got off lightly. So, mm-hmm. I mean, if you think about California, which is now experiencing a big rise in cases, this was seen a couple of months ago as a success story, in the sense that they locked down earlier in the course of where the disease was, and they managed to suppress it. But now, with the imperatives of opening up and over the summer and keeping people's livelihoods going, you are seeing cases going up. So you're seeing that happen across America. I don't think that's something to worry about in particular, because you've got to weigh the kind of crude notion that further outbreaks are happening with the level of risk associated with the people it's happening to. So it's interesting, mm-hmm. in America, the average age of people now registering as positive of coronavirus is effectively halved. So the epidemic, coupled with advanced testing, is probably entering this stage where it only becomes truly disastrous and visible when it comes into contact with the fully susceptible populations. And I mean, when I say fully susceptible to developing the disease that creates hospitalization and pressure on health services. Anyway, that's a kind of long answer to, I think in Europe it's effectively over, because, there's enough community immunity or to develop pretty harsh restrictions on where the disease can go. And I think that's what partly explains what's happening in London, where we've had over a month of people effectively socializing pretty normally. The number of stories of friends of mine who've been in situations where it's, social distancing is not possible, whether that's in the park or even in people's houses, you'd expect to see some sort of bump in cases, but nothing's really happened. And I think in Europe, we've actually had a terrible experience, especially in the UK, but it's effectively over. But in other parts of the world, as the winter comes in, particularly watch out for Australia, where a lot of people, there is no inbuilt immunity to the population, and they're really struggling, I think, in Melbourne to suppress an outbreak. Yeah. But anyway, that's a rambling answer, but there we are.
I'll come back to you in a minute, Alistair, just on why the UK, it turns out, has had such a terrible experience. But Maggie, are you as sanguine as Alistair in terms of it having passed, or this peak of it having passed?
I think if you see the various reports coming out from the Swedish Institute and then Oxford University researchers today talking about suggesting that probably up to 30% of the population do have some sort of immunity, then in a sense, you can put it into context. You can see perhaps why it is dying out and why the levels amongst the younger people were relatively low. And maybe I'm being too optimistic, but it did seem to me that if it was such a great pandemic, it really only hit the vulnerable people. Therefore, why weren't younger people getting it? That's because they had some sort of immunity. And they're now showing that T cells, or just exposure to a common cold, would actually be protective against COVID. So that has to be quite a positive. That has to be very positive. What would now be very interesting is if we could have sort of full-scale national antibody testing just to see how many people have built up the antibodies.
Yeah.
And but are you then anticipating then, Maggie, that we get, I hate the term second wave, but some sort of further peak in the autumn, winter or not?
Gosh, I think it's impossible to tell, isn't it? And what will show that is what happens in places like Australia as they go into winter. I guess that's why we have to maintain some sort of social distancing over the next few weeks, over the next few months, to try and keep it to a minimum. So,
yeah, Alistair, I was just going to ask Alistair the same question about, you said to me the other day when we were talking about this on the Reaction editorial conference call that you thought that there would be another peak or peaks. Do you still think that? And say a bit more about why you think Britain has had the experience that it's had. What did we do wrong, or how did we get unlucky?
Yeah, so I think there will be a second peak, but this will be a second peak when, and this is a very sad thing to say, is this disease only becomes visible in populations when it hits vulnerable people. And we've had that experience with care homes, with the age profile of people who have died in the first wave and in the number of excess deaths. And I think the real problem for people is those who are vulnerable and who are shielding. Now, this disease has a long way to go in the vulnerable population. It's killed a lot of people who would have been susceptible to dying with it. And that's why we've had an awful death rate, because we've allowed it to rip through vulnerable populations. And that's a product of government messaging being incredibly shambolic and through strategic incompetence. And plus, it is very dangerous to vulnerable people. And it's hit a system which has long been poor at sheltering people with specific vulnerabilities and needs. But I think this is the real danger, is that in a year's time, and I really expect the coronavirus, it can fade out in a general way, but it can still be very dangerous. And I expect it will become a circulating disease. In a year's time, when people who are shielding basically become fatigued with the process. And shielding is an incredibly difficult thing to do, you know, not leaving the front doorstep, but effectively replicating lockdown conditions for not just months, but potentially over a year is almost impossible. And I think that's the danger. If that coincides with the winter, you're going to see serious stress on health services. And in answer to the second point, why have we done so badly? It's because we've effectively had an uncontrolled epidemic in this country. We are the most... London is an incredibly interconnected global hub where the infection would have been seeded very fast. Our epidemic is not like on the continent. And we talk about Italy and Spain and France in comparable terms to our own epidemic. It's not the same. In France, it was basically located within the Île-de-France and Paris and a couple of regions. In Italy, it hit the north, not really hitting it in the south of Italy. I don't know so much about Spain, actually, but in Britain, I think it's because of patterns of air travel in February and March coming back from the continent, it was seeded from the north to the south and from the northeast to the south, basically in all our urban and in the central belts in Scotland. So I think either we needed to lock down about in sort of when it was kicking off in Italy, so in February the 20th, which was over a month before we actually locked down, or we should have persisted with whatever the government's sort of incoherent herd immunity policy, in the sense that they started believing in this vision of herd immunity because they realized that there wasn't really another way out. Or maybe that's over psychologizing it.
I think that of course, they would say that they didn't definitely did not believe in herd immunity. So that's the official line. But they clearly believed that what was being done in Italy, for whatever reason, didn't really fit with the British system or the British experience. And as Jeremy Hunt's put it, as chair of the health committee, former health secretary, they had a pandemic plan, but it turns out it was for the wrong disease. One of the things that troubles me about where we are now, and it'd be interesting to see if there's any shift in government communications over the next couple of months, is that there's still not being, I think, honest enough or straightforward enough with the population. Because I think you're right, Alistair, that it's going to be quite a long haul, and the messaging is really going to matter. And it can no longer just be as blunt as, you know, stay home, save lives. It's going to involve sometimes local measures, periodic adjustments, emphasis on social distancing, and encouraging people to be as sensible as possible. And I think the thing which has happened in Leicester, and the wider argument about access to data, which the government says that the councils did have the data, councils say not so much. It's unclear exactly who's right in that. Is that it's born of an approach at the centre which is not yet sophisticated or grown up enough, or rather, it doesn't treat the population as though the population is grown up. So you end up with a situation where the messaging is incoherent. I think some of the stuff that's been communicated in France, and I was talking to an MP earlier about this, who was very interesting on the subject about how French locally, how they've communicated information, the data. You look at their briefings on television, they weren't like those terrible briefings that the British specialised in, the daily briefings, where there was never any admission of a mistake having been made. I think we need to move to something. If we are going to be in this for the next couple of years in one form or another, don't you think, Maggie, we need to, as a country, start sort of treating the population like grown-ups? Or is that too optimistic?
It's probably far too optimistic. But no, I agree totally. And that was one of the things that the French did very well. They openly accepted that they'd made mistakes. And I think what happened here, two things actually. One is, I want to go back to what Alistair was saying about February the 20th. And I agree that it seems to be, from everything you look at, that basically London was saturated the half-term week from Italy and from France. And it was in the country, because actually most of those deaths were the last week of March, weren't they? That's when the peak came, and through to mid-April. And because of our global hub, because of our tube network, trains, Birmingham Airport, it went from London in Birmingham within days and then just spread up like wildfire up through the northwest, through the middle and to the northwest. And that's what we're still seeing now. So it would only have been effective if they'd closed the country down that week. Otherwise, you know, even a week later would almost have been too late. So I think we missed it by about a month. And I think the other big issue that it throws up is the state of our care homes. I mean, something radical will have to be done to help them through this winter. But going back to messaging, I think the obsession with protecting the NHS, it sort of clouded everything else. And, you know, the whole sort of happy clappy thing, it was all brilliant and they were absolutely right to do it. But I felt that, you know, they weren't, it was this obsession with protecting it, but rather than explaining what was actually happening, and that will have to change. And I'm not sure Hancock can do it.
It was a very strange British approach, wasn't it? This idea of protecting the NHS, whereas it's supposed to be there to protect us. That's kind of the point of paying.
Save lives, first of all, and then by doing that, you will help help the NHS to cope. And as my son said, right sort of from the first week, he said, basically what they're saying is ICU beds are full and they want to keep you at home until they can cope with it. It's a sort of simple, crude mathematical equation, which really is treating us like idiots, isn't it? Completely.
Should we just move on Maggie, to the economy, and just ask you to say a bit about where you think things stand, because there is the, I was going to call it the not budget next week, but the big statement from the Chancellor, Rishi Sunak, which will give some kind of indication on how the government sees things and what happens next on the economy. How do you think the country's placed?
From what we're hearing, and Andy Haldane gave, he's not prone to optimism. So actually his speech yesterday suggesting that the fundamentals are not as ghastly as one thought, that consumer spending has come back, even if it's sort of online and remote spending, has come back rather faster than they hoped. What people will be looking at from Rishi Sunak is what, he doesn't have much to play with, frankly. He can't put up taxes, but what levers can he use to help improve people's confidence, get investment going again? So there are a range of options he has, cutting VAT, maybe for all the companies that are on furlough schemes, he can give some sort of national insurance holiday, because clearly the huge elephant in the room is the scale of the unemployment. We've had figures of 3 million. And already this week, we've seen thousands of jobs go from airlines, retail, hospitality. These are the really vulnerable, fragile areas. And frankly, you know, I'm not sure a VAT cut or a national insurance cut is going to help them survive. What else can he do? He could improve incentives for people who do have money to invest in startups and SMEs. We all know that that's where the growth comes from. I hope he does. I hope he's bold enough to do that. Really, it will be
the thing I'd really like to see him do. And yeah. I'm like you, Maggie. I hope that Haldane is right, and he's one of the most interesting thinkers around about economics, and he's always stimulating. I don't quite. It's just instinct. I can't see how you can do what's being done to a sector like airlines, by which I include airports, and you consider the amount of retail and cargo and the rest there is in that, just the infrastructure of UK airports. I don't see how you can savage that in the way that the crisis has, and then add in restaurants, pubs, most of the hotel sector, theatres, and tourism, and not end up with the most extraordinary long-lasting damage. If that doesn't bounce back, and not all, clearly you only need about a quarter of that to not come back for there to be sustained economic damage. I hope I'm wrong, and other activity is happening which makes up for it. Interestingly, one thing which I saw flagged up today was the Primark statement.
Yes.
About their trading. I don't know if you saw it, Maggie, that they, quite remarkable in one sense, is that they're trading, I think, for last month, for the month just gone, June, or the equivalent week, the tail end of June, was only 12% lower, at the tills, than it had been in the equivalent week last year. Now, that sounds remarkable in one sense, but it did. I was discussing this with someone. Maybe there's a new rule here in shopping, is that the crisis kills a lot of window shopping.
Yeah.
As in just sort of wandering around and then going for a coffee, as people like doing that. I'm not criticizing it. But that you now, in the crisis, or post-crisis, if you need something, you go and you buy it.
Yeah.
So the shops are empty, but you're still but a higher proportion of the customers who are in the store are actually buying something, is what I mean. So that might be happening as well.
Yeah, I think that one of the keys to this whole question is to what extent and how much our behaviour has been changed by the experience of lockdown. So a lot of people found themselves for 3 months, for the first time in their lives, not buying those window shopping, not buying clothes, not having, you know, all the dresses from ASOS being sent, or Boohoo, all these sort of in between, which is why I think Primark has done so well, because I think people are being careful. So if people have learnt they don't need a new dress or pair of trousers every week, that might see a lot of the excess, you know, disappear. If people are not going to restaurants, maybe they're going to spend on other things. So it's where we spend it, isn't it? But I don't think people will stop spending.
I didn't finish my point about what I'd like to see him do most of all.
Yeah.
And it's in relation to startup culture. And I think after a week where you've had lots of talk about big government and FDR and the Tories trying to restyle themselves as the party of the interventionist state, in a way they don't have a choice because that's what they're doing. And the sums involved are so huge. I kept seeing people say, you know, it's only 5 billion. That doesn't count as a new deal, but that's 5 billion among what's effectively somewhere between 150 and 250 billion. And, you know, and rising depending on how long the crisis starts. So the scale of government intervention is huge, but there's so little on where the growth is really going to come from. And we know history tells us it's really ultimately, if it's to be sustainable, it's going to come from people starting companies and growing existing companies. And what the government should be doing as much as possible, for a reason I'll come to in a second, is to encourage people to start and grow companies. Now, I think there's going to be a peculiar characteristic of this coming recession, which is, and I'm sorry to say, I've heard this from quite a few friends in various different industries, I think a lot of corporates and corporate finance directors have concluded via the world of Zoom and off-site working that not only can you save costs by not having a vast office, but that actually you can probably do what the company was doing before in terms of output with about a quarter fewer staff.
Yeah.
And I think that really difficult discussion is already happening in companies, and we'll see in the autumn a lot of white collar workers who have status and have quite a lot of experience finding themselves out of a job and wondering what to do. Now, what we know from previous recessions is that they need very quickly to be encouraged to get motivated and to get out there. And if there aren't going to be the corporate jobs for them to find, then stuff is going to have to be done to encourage them very quickly and to incentivize them through the tax system to start something, to start their own. Maybe it's just their own little consultancy initially, or maybe it's a business idea that they wanted to do, because that's where it's going to come from. I don't think there's going to be a corporate rebound next year. If people are pinning their hopes on that, I think corporates will get by on a smaller workforce than they had before. Does that seem right or wrong to you, Maggie?
No, absolutely. I mean, we've already seen it. BP, Shell, they're shedding, you know, this is HSBC, they're shedding people by the thousands. And even in retail, actually, it's not the lockdown that's forcing a lot of these job losses. They were already zombie companies. Debenhams going, well, this was the last push. Debenhams and Laura Ashley should have been out of business 10 years ago, frankly. So there'll be a lot of clearing out. But that's why I think if I was Sunak or could have his ear on Tuesday night before he talks, the first thing is you put up the limit on EIS and SEIS, because actually there are an awful lot of people who are sitting there with a lot of money. If you say to them, you know, this is tax-free, capital gains-free, a lot of people won't like that. They'll say, oh, it's a tax benefit for the rich, but it's only by other people investing in you, these people you're talking about who lose their jobs, that we'll see growth. So hopefully they get that.
Yeah.
But the Treasury doesn't always understand growth, does it? Sadly.
Or small companies.
No, the growth will, we already, SMEs employ over half the working population already, and they're the ones that will provide the new jobs. So it's absolutely imperative that he gives some sort of catalyst for growth.
But
just, Alistair, I was going to ask you, what did you make of the Boris FDR Rooseveltian stuff this week? And indeed, more broadly, what's your take on where the government is at the moment?
That's a really good question, and I'm not really sure. I found There's several things. There's, you know, the story that the government was shaping itself around in January, i.e. institutional reform, wide-ranging root and branch reform to the function and practice of government, is kind of reasserting itself. And whether you think it's time to do that or not seems to be a bit of a political thing at the moment. But I even felt in January, there's a lot of the conversation over Whitehall reform, cutting red tape, streamlining, was effectively an argument we've had for decades about the status of Whitehall and efficiency and bureaucracy and all that. And I didn't think, I'm always struck. I mean, I was struck at the weekend by Michael Gove's speech about good, what he sees as a vision of good government. And clearly it's a conversation that's been triggered by the fact that the West's institutional superiority that was established after the war in the post-war reconstruction. I mean, you look at West Germany, it's an incredible soft power example of the West's capacity to innovate with institutions. And it's an enduring thing, I think, that thing. And you've written about it for Engelsberg Ideas, Ian. There's this sense, not just here but in America, that the West is a place of both technological and institutional prowess has really died a death. And the coronavirus has exposed that, but also lots, you know, it's been a long-term decline. And the new Asian democracies, which weren't democracies for much of the 20th century, but like South Korea or even Taiwan, and now seem to be at the forefront of actually both soft power culture and economic and technical change, with China as a special and interesting example. And I think that's, they've really cottoned onto that at the centre, and they think it's a great idea that Britain should be part of a kind of Eurasian coming together between, you know, the new world and the old decaying one. And it's all fine and well, but it's all presented as if it's the most controversial thing in the world. I mean, you talk to most civil servants, they would agree that the churn in Whitehall is probably, you know, is not advantageous.
It's much worse among the politicians. So the politicians who complain about this, they have an extraordinary churn and turnover on between departments themselves, and then criticise senior civil servants.
Exactly, but there is a point to me. You know, career advancement in the civil service does often happen if you continually switch departments. That's true, but it's also, yeah, I feel there's a lot of displacement activity. The British system still does work well if there's a lot of coordination, and that's been seen in the capacity of our search for new treatments, where there's been an extraordinary effort resulting in a new standard of care for coronavirus, which is the steroid drug dexamethasone. And that was done through stuff that could really only happen in Britain, which is a hugely over-centralised system, plus actually a lot of really great expertise. Alison, I feel there's...
Can I interrupt? Wasn't that a perfect example, actually, of our institutions, in a rare occurrence, working perfectly with the private sector? Because they brought in GSK, the researchers at Oxford, a lot of them from the private sector, and they did actually work brilliantly to deliver that within weeks. And so that was a wonderful example of the old and new working well.
Yeah, and I think it's, you're right, Ian, say, but I still think the government, there is a sense of drift, and I don't really know, and I think it's going to be, there's two arguments. There's, on the one side, you say, okay, Boris has a, weirdly comes through this well, the economy via, you know, what Haldane was saying, actually the fundamentals are strong, it picks up quickly. Boris can open up pubs in that great symbolic gesture. He can open up the economy. People still, in my view, weirdly see the economic damage as sort of necessary and inevitable, whereas the health stuff sort of in the long run avoidable. So I think there is, you know, but I think the government needs to stop proceeding by focus group and stop trying to gauge the public mood every 5 seconds. And it's one of these curious contradictions at the heart of the institution. There's all this talk about long-term structural change, but in reality, I think a lot of the decisions coming through the advisors or whatever are driven by a relentless attitude that, you know, which comes from the Brexit debate, where you say we need to gauge the mood of the public because it has been too ignored for too long by elites captured by, you know, monochrome thinking, and actually the diversity of the country is showing you a different picture. And that's all well and good, but it's also not a good way to govern, I think.
I do wonder, and this is going to sound really, really bleak, and I feel terrible now because you two cheered me up with the idea that there were these great examples of private and public partnership, and that things did go right in the crisis. Not everything went wrong for the British, but I wonder whether historians might not see this as a continuum, as a series, which, if you think of, I mean, personally, the greatest shock to me in post 9/11 and with the Iraq intervention was that I thought, well, look, people say the Americans have never done nation building, but they did what you described, Alistair, brilliantly in Germany. And there's another standout example which works for a long time, which is post-war Japan. And then the catastrophe unfolds in Iraq, which, as someone like me, radicalized by 9/11, I made an assumption about about American power and about the American state that could loosely be described as they know what they're doing. They must know what they're doing. Turned out they didn't know what they were doing. That then bleeds into the financial crisis. We get a similar experience where the West clearly doesn't know what it's doing. Then into COVID. And I'm afraid I fell for it again. I look at the stuff I wrote in early March about how we have a plan as a country. There is a pandemic plan. Why are people being so agitated about it? And some people were jumping up and down, like Rory Stewart, who turned out, it seems to be right, very early on to recommend early lockdown. And it was rooted again with me, and I think with lots of other people, in the idea that, well, they must know what they're doing, and they didn't. So there's something dysfunctional. It's not just about beating up on the UK state. It's obviously there in the US as well, and it's not just restricted to Britain. In Europe, other countries have struggled, but there is something something fundamentally deficient about the design of the Western state that needs revitalized or rethought in some way. I don't necessarily think that Dominic Cummings' approach is anything like the right one. And I think if you want to change things, you have to persuade people, and persuading people often means at least being polite to them or being nice to them. So it's not necessarily his approach is not the best way to proceed, but something's up.
Yeah, well, it is a criticism that's potentially leveled at that Cummings view, is that at least some of those crises came about through almost an overload of planning, but in the wrong direction. And it's not like people are constantly, before the financial crash, people were talking about, you know, a crisis in lending and all these issues. But to know, you know, in the end, the resilience sort of only came in as a last resort and saved things. And I think you're totally right about the structure of the century so far, to put it in very over aggrandizing terms, the structure of the century does not look one that particularly favors the Anglo-American system. You know, 9/11, then the terrible costs of overreach, the financial crisis, a crisis made in the Western financial system.
It's not looking good, yeah, but then come
the pandemic, on. Where we there's this total, you know, I remember having a really, you're totally right, Ian. I feel really bad about it. I remember having an argument with a friend of mine who now lives in Taiwan. And she was saying they're doing temperature screening, the trade-off is much more orientated towards protecting people's health against security and freedom with safeguards. You know, people are being quarantined, all these things. And I sort of said, well, you know, the British, you know, we've got this contain and mitigate plan, and, you know, it's just a different experience. And I actually feel quite bad about having that argument without really understanding that maybe our approach is actually faulty. And it's not, yeah, it's not just a difference of opinion. We're actually we're actually heading in the wrong direction.
Maybe some of these states know something that we don't know, or that there's a lot more we can learn from them. Mm. Go on, Maggie, cheer us up.
I'm going to cheer you up, but also maybe depress you at the same time. I think it's really dangerous to compare all these different countries' reactions to COVID. And in many ways, I think we've done brilliantly, apart from care homes and the most vulnerable. But there are perfect storm issues, as we've talked about before, why we were hit so badly. Would you rather live in Taiwan or Britain? Would you rather live in Iraq or Britain? Maybe that's perhaps not the question I should be putting, but we still have a very tolerant nation. And I think why I liked Michael Gove's speech, there might have been a lot of platitudes there, but what we do is we constantly question ourselves. And I think he's right to. He might not have the right analysis, he might not have the right solutions, but at least we're asking the questions. And that's what did Tancredi say in The Leopard? He says, for things to stay the same, things must change if they're to stay the same, right? So we have this constant analysis. That's much healthier than being under an authoritarian regime elsewhere in the world. My second point is that human nature is frail. We think we build these wonderful resilience task force and we can cope with it. But actually, this is something we've never dealt with before. It sort of hit us within a few weeks. So to think that we could cope with it beautifully and protect everyone and to find the right way out of it, well, it's just too, I don't think it's possible for mankind to do that.
Yeah.
So, you know,
yeah.
Well, listen, on that,
but we're not that bad.
Yeah, on that slightly more uplifting note, you said it was uplifting and depressing, but it contained the seeds of optimism. I think we have to wind things up there simply because, Maggie, you've got to go and sort out the reaction evening email in time so we can all get a glass of wine. And there's a lot happening with Hong Kong and various other stories. And so just before we wrap up, I just wanted to thank you for listening. And if you're not a reaction subscriber, I can't believe that that's the case, you go to the site www.reaction.life. And it is only £6 per month to become a subscriber. You get my newsletter. You get access to all of the brilliant journalism by the Reaction team. There's great writing on the site. And you get invites to our events. There are more live/Zoom events with leading authors and thinkers happening soon. And if you're on our mailing list or you're a subscriber, you'll be alerted to those in the next few days. But until next time, thank you very much for listening to the Reaction Podcast.